Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast. As you know, BFRR explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies, and ultimately helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I'm your host today, Jonas Groß, and in today's episode, we are talking again about the topic of a Bitcoin reserve. In episode 328, already a few weeks back, we discussed the pro side, so the arguments in favor of having central banks or states invest in Bitcoin and build up such a Bitcoin or strategic Bitcoin reserve, together with Frank Schaeffler from the German Liberal Party, which we will also link again in the show notes. And today we rather explore the con side and discuss arguments against such a Bitcoin reserve. And for this discussion today, we are thrilled to have Dr. Jürgen Scharf with us. Dr. Jürgen Scharf is advisor to the senior management of the market infrastructure and payments business area of the European Central Bank, or ECB. Before that, he was counselor to the executive board of the ECB, was personal advisor to the governor of the Central Bank of Luxembourg, also worked as an ECB watcher at the German Börsenzeitung magazine, and was senior economist at Deutsche Bank. So quite a track record that Jürgen has. And Jürgen studied economics in Marburg and Canterbury, and also holds a PhD in economics from the Philipps University, Marburg. Last but not least to mention, maybe before we go into this episode today, Jürgen also might be known for our BFR community by commenting on Bitcoin in various research papers, articles, podcasts, events. So I'm sure you crossed his name and his arguments, his work around Bitcoin. Jürgen, it is a really, really great pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Jonas, for having me. Pleasure.
Yeah, and let's directly go into the topic. Let's not waste our times and directly go in the topic today, which is Bitcoin reserve, and maybe start with Bitcoin generally. So maybe you can let us know, Jürgen, when was kind of the first time you heard about Bitcoin, and how did you come to the topic of Bitcoin?
I actually had to check when that was. I couldn't recall the effective time when I was confronted with Bitcoin first, but it was in the mid 2010s. What I could find was that in 2014, the board member I was working for at the ECB was giving a speech, and that was actually quite critical. And in my then job, I was always involved in the speech preparation. So that was the first time I was confronted with Bitcoin professionally.
And that was pretty early, actually, right? And
yes, I was surprised when I saw that. then, as a citizen, I'm not sure if I was confronted with it earlier. At least I cannot recall any particular event. But over the time, there were ups and downs, and in my work, I was confronted. And as an economist, I understood it as a niche phenomenon at the beginning, and then it accelerated. It increased in importance, and the attraction it gained brought me back to that. And when I change jobs within the ECB, when I went to payments, I had a closer look at all these phenomena, and I started to be a bit more interested. And then the first time I went public on Bitcoin was in mid-2021, together with Ulrich Binzeil, co-authored an article in FAZ, which was called in English, Don't Get Fooled by Bitcoin, with a reference to the greater fool theory. I never liked the headline that much, but that's part of the business. And I was confronted with the first shitstorm on Twitter in my life.
Yeah, this was then your welcome to a crypto Twitter, or crypto X, how we now call it, right?
indeed. But I have recovered.
Okay, that's really great to hear. So basically, to summarize this, Jürgen, you first heard of this, I think, really pretty early. So even earlier than I did. I think for me, it was 2016, 2017. It was more, a niche, and just heard about it. And then you basically came back like very deeply into the topic, around four or five years ago. And then also became basically a vocal voice, if you will, around this topic in different outlets, let's say.
Yes, and maybe to mention, so I think my first confrontation with it was in a professional context, but the drive and the ambition to speak about it publicly, that was more a personal one as an economist and intellectual, rather than there was a mandate by the ECB or anything. So, of course, I always check with our colleagues here that I don't want to interfere with any policies or public statements or stance or anything, but that was not mandated or anything by the ECB. And I'm quite lucky to have this liberal work environment that when you think there's something to say, you're allowed to do so.
So it's really your, you know, kind of your private interest, or you're not maybe private, but the interest as a curious economist to go deeper into that topic then, right? And not mandated.
Indeed, task. But I also have to add that I'm not aware of any recognized academic economist who would have a supportive stance vis-a-vis Bitcoin. So as there are many economists at the ECB and in the central banking community, it's more difficult to find supporters there than elsewhere.
There are definitely
some.
Yeah, there are definitely some. And yeah, you see, you know, there's definitely a different sentiment, you know, on academia, on X, and also in the general public about these topics. And that's also why we really want to, you know, cover all sides as part of this podcast. I mean, you're also an economist, Jürgen, you know, also did your PhD in this field. What were your immediate thoughts, you know, when you first heard around it? Or maybe also how did it change over time, if there was a change?
So I would say there were two reactions in the confrontation, and one was the fascination of the innovation, the endurance, the sustainability up to now. It's intellectually fascinating. I did my PhD on Schumpeterian economics, so I was always attracted to technological inventions and their market entry via innovation. That was fascinating. Also fascinating was how the whole thing grew, the market size, the attraction it gained, and so on and so on. But at the same time, right from the beginning, I was thinking, this is a scam. And over time, my assessment has not changed in terms of quality, but it's probably one of the biggest scams in financial history.
So then, you know, I think that's a really good transition to really come directly, you know, into the topic, and why you also, you know, think, you know, it's a scam and not a good idea to maybe, you know, pull it out politely. And, you know, what we are doing today, maybe also for the audience, is that we basically centered the discussion around an article that you, together with Ulrich Binzer, wrote again for the FAZ magazine in January, where you laid out a few arguments, you know, why Bitcoin, from your perspective, you know, is not as good as many think, let's say, and also why a Bitcoin reserve, you know, shouldn't become reality at some point. So that's basically, yeah, and we will link this article in the show notes, of course, as well, how we, you know, kind of center this discussion today. And we also do see that the topic of a Bitcoin reserve is still very, very, you know, important, and also, you know, has a lot of momentum again. We've seen Trump, like one week back now when we record this, really moved again the markets, because he took another tweet on, you know, he will push this topic, he will include Bitcoin, ETH, and others. I mean, of course, he cannot decide this himself, but we do see there is a lot of interest, at least from the political side in the US, to make this possible. And there are even some people saying on Friday, actually 2 days, 2 days after we publish this episode, there could already be an announcement on that. I'm a little bit skeptical if this will indeed come, but you see, this topic is really, really important. That's why it's also important to discuss again today. So going into that, Jürgen, if we think about, you know, your skepticism around Bitcoin and what you said, you know, that from your perspective, it's a scam. What is maybe, you know, the first reason why you think that?
The original promise to have a payment system for e-commerce that is completely detached from the government, that's completely decentralized, is superior to the existing established payment systems, actually never materialized. So you don't see effectively a sizable market share in terms of retail payments. You have high costs. It's slow, and it's often used for illicit activities. It then over time, but I guess we discussed this later, turned the narrative. The narrative was changed away from an alternative, innovative, libertarian payment system into an asset that will grow in value forever. the narrative has changed, but let's discuss that later and maybe start and focus on the original promise that has actually never materialized outside a niche.
So basically, you mean the initial vision that Satoshi also had in mind with the white paper, right? To basically establish a global payment system, some kind of another version of cash, even if this reference is not, you know, the right one, and that it's just a niche and it did not, you know, really reach its promise.
Indeed, indeed.
Let's say. Yeah, and I mean, what I was thinking about now is, and you mentioned this as part of this aspect as well, that one of the reasons is that it's pretty cumbersome to do, right, and does not really have a good user experience, which I remember, you know, when I started going into Bitcoin and you know, trying this out, I think 7-8 years ago, it was of course super 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 complicated, right? So I have to admit that I personally started with a certificate because for me it was too risky to do it myself. So of course this is kind of changed, but this was a starting point to somehow understand how this market dynamic works. And I mean, what I could now imagine, I mean, thinking about of some of the Bitcoiners, you know, which sometimes I already hear in my head, is that, of course, you could also argue that generally Bitcoin payments are actually pretty easy to do because you can scan a QR code. It's pretty, you know, pretty simple, maybe even simpler than, you know, I don't know, a PayPal account or credit card payment. You know, isn't that also an angle of this, you know, user experience?
Are you referring to the involvement of a Lightning system or really an effective on blockchain transaction with Bitcoin?
Actually both, but what I was more referring to Lightning, because here this QR system,
okay. Yeah.
You know, is, yeah.
No, that's good. Okay. The Lightning system definitely is a very impressive technological improvement. However, I'm pretty sure you can improve the Lightning system and you can develop other second layers, third layers, and additional tools to make transactions based and related and linked to Bitcoin better and faster and cheaper. There are two or three caveats with that. The first thing is it's a violation of the original idea of the blockchain-based Bitcoin. It doesn't have the level of security that the proof-of-work concept promises. There are a couple of technical caveats in the current Lightning system, which may be overcome in the future. So it's not so decentralized as the on-chain transactions. There are some security concerns. There are other things. So, and you could improve all of these things more and more and more. If you do that, you would probably move step by step closer to those aids and additional layers that the traditional financial system uses. So, for example, at one point you would realize that you cannot grant a loan in the effective core Bitcoin universe. Then someone comes up with an idea how to do that. So you would, if you target all the shortcomings of the true Bitcoin transactions and the true Bitcoin concept, you would move closer to what you actually want to overcome. But that's more a philosophical, ideological discussion. Leave that aside. The second critical point or caveat is that even if you make the transactions with Bitcoin via Lightning or something else faster, easier, cheaper, you still do not get rid of the volatility of the underlying asset. So in my view, the reason why, despite the simplicity of the Lightning network, which is actually, I would say, a bit more complicated than most of the modern front ends of electronic payments, the reason why people still don't use it that much is that the underlying asset, the Bitcoin itself, is too volatile for retail payments and the like.
So what you're actually saying, Jürgen, please correct me if I got this wrong, is saying, you know, there are ways to make basically Bitcoin more user-friendly, to make it also quicker and cheaper. For example, the Lightning Network or maybe another technology that will work on that. But what the key issue is that this basically comes at the expense of some of the initial value propositions that Bitcoin had in mind, right? One being security, which is higher for on-chain transaction, decentralization, which obviously is higher for on-chain transaction. So that was basically one point you were making in that.
Yeah, way. And one important thing is that we have to distinguish between the transaction and the asset. So I think the shortcomings that we see in the velocity and the price duration of the transaction is one thing, the underlying asset is a different thing. And I'm pretty sure you can have a lot of improvements in terms of improving, speeding up the transactions, but this doesn't free you from the restrictions and the shortcomings of the underlying assets, which probably will never be overcome. For example, the volatility in the absence of a central institution or controller that can interfere in case of a market crash or when volatility is too high will probably make it impossible to stabilize the value in such a way that it will be sufficiently stable.
Yeah. And I mean, this volatility issue, of course, that's still one that is very important today, right? Because we even see the volatility like last weekend, right? Where a tweet is kind of moving the markets, let's say by 10%, maybe in one direction or in the other. And I also have to say that this is often an argument which, you know, the whole Bitcoin space is often saying, but, you know, isn't volatility a good thing, you know, good sign for good markets, right? And I mean, if in the long run, the Bitcoin price increases, the volatility doesn't matter. And, you know, I get this one, right? So if the trend is always upwards, it doesn't matter, but just depending on how long you hold it, right? So if you're going into the asset at a time where you're the price is maybe not as good, but then you go out when it dropped, right? Then of course it's still an issue, and there are maybe people, you know, that cannot afford it to hold longer, or maybe this trend will reverse, as we don't know, right? So what I'm saying, this volatility, is indeed, I think, a very, you know, important challenge.
Yes. So the volatility as such is an issue when you want to use something for everyday payments, and depending on your income and your wealth situation, this can really kill you if you are not in the middle class level or even higher. That's an issue. And the second thing, even if this volatility was not there, but the price would only go up for good, then you would have a deflationary environment, which is not too attractive for a currency to use. So when you know prices go down, you tend to hoard your money, your currency, because you expect goods and durables to become cheaper over time. Then you hold your spending back to wait, and that has a negative impact on aggregate demand. So in the crypto and Bitcoin community, there's often the critique on the inflationary fiat system, if you will, but it does not appreciate sufficiently the risks and the damaging consequences of a deflationary money. So even if we had no highly volatile Bitcoin price, and even if it only goes up as a scenario, it would not be fit for purpose, because deflationary money has an impact on aggregate demand and is damaging to the economy.
So here, that's also something where probably, you know, one needs to differentiate between the function or being used as money and being as like a store of value, or, you know, something that you don't spend immediately, because as you said, you know, this will have an impact on the velocity. Because I mean, if you go to a supermarket, if you talk to a merchant, right, you of course want that prices are somehow stable. I mean, you can now discuss, you know, does it need to be 0%, 1% or 2%, you know, definitely not going into this direction. That's an impact as a means of payment versus maybe as a, you know, as a store of value or an asset class, maybe. Mm-hmm.
There are two things. So these, you need the three functions of money: unit of account, store of value, and means of exchange. You cannot choose one. If you want it to be money, it has to fulfill the three of them. One niche aspect of the debate about the menu cost in groceries, supermarkets, and the like. So there's the so-called thing of a menu cost. So the owner of the grocery store doesn't like to change the price tags on a daily or weekly basis. So even if there are some volatility, a bit of volatility underneath in the production cost, in the purchasing cost, and so he would leave the menu as it is, the restaurant will not react to a temporary spike in raw material prices or food prices. But it's if the volatility is as high as we currently have seen it with Bitcoin, you would have to change the price tags so often that the transaction cost of this would really make it unattractive.
And this is really something which reminds me of my econ bachelor degrees, where you exactly talk about the issues of inflation and definitely being one cost driver here. Maybe coming back to another aspect you made, Jürgen, which was about the use of Bitcoin, where you basically said that it's rarely used for illicit activities and primarily for illicit ones, be it around money laundering, ransom. That's, I think, a topic around for quite a while. One could now argue is, didn't this improve a lot? Because if you look into Chainalysis data, right, I think it's currently less than 0.5% or something on illicit use. What would you say around that?
So let's start with the anecdotal evidence. Have a look around when you are confronted. You are probably more confronted with the use of Bitcoin than I am, but you hardly see here any illicit usage in the real context of Bitcoin. If you go shopping, if you go to a restaurant, you will have difficulties to pay with Bitcoin.
At least niche, right? I remember I went to a mountain here to hike and I could pay with Bitcoin, but I have to say it's not everywhere.
Yeah. And those who do it often do it as a marketing tool. So in my neighborhood, there's a driver's license school. They also have a Bitcoin sign there. That means that you can pay that with Bitcoin. But normally this is a marketing thing to attract young people, and they probably do it, but normally they convert it, or it's not used for general transaction in our everyday life. That's the one thing. Then the Chainalysis reports have a couple of weaknesses. One is, and they are transparent about it, so no critique there. One is that they often have to change the number and the size of illicit activities and transactions a year later, because at the moment of their when is the cutoff date for their data collection, a couple of illicit activities haven't been discovered. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, the correction of their findings a year later is factor 0.5 or 1, 1.5 times to 2 times more. The second thing is, it doesn't include proceeds from crimes which have originally conducted in normal money and then were converted to crypto. So if you have some drug dealing in the dark corners of Frankfurt, for example, in cash, and thereafter the drug dealers convert their cash into Bitcoin, this will not be recorded as illicit activity. And that is probably one big part. And then the last thing that's probably most important one, the numerator, so the illicit activities, is probably too small, because we don't know where the money comes from. We don't see the illicit activities prior to conversion are not included in the numerator. And then the second thing is that the denominator is probably far too big when we want to talk about real transactions, because the biggest chunk of what is been done on the blockchain is financial transactions, sheer financial transactions, including washing and the like. So our clear conviction is that in particular, the denominator is blurred and inflated by the sheer financial activities and thereby washing and the like. Having said that, talking about the illicit activities, what I think is true is that indeed stable coins, particular stable coins, are gaining more importance in money laundering, in terrorist financing, and other illicit activities. The reason of which is, again, that the stable coins are less volatile and have other features what people need in that context. So I think that transactions outside the only financial, pure financial transactions, so with a context to reality, to real transactions, the illicit activities still play a major role, but stable coins are crowding them a bit out over time.
Do you actually have an, let's say, as you know, a good source or institution in mind for this kind of data? So I'm asking because, I mean, I remember, you know, from statistic, you know, empirical economics, that you always need to be careful where the data come from, right? So if you ask the Bitcoin industry about a Bitcoin, the data will be biased to the one direction. If you ask, for example, the banking sector, maybe it's, you know, based to, or, you know, downward, you know, on a different direction. Do you have any source in mind for that? Because I'm actually looking for that, and maybe also for the audience. If you do, please let us know, because yeah, I think that's really important for such discussions to really have a, you know, a solid basis to have such good sources, which I also haven't seen besides.
No, I haven't. If I had found something, I would have put it here on my table and read from it. No, I think Chainalysis is serious. Enterprise, and if you talk to them, they also agree on the shortcomings on the data that they have, but they make that, in my assessment, quite transparent.
All right, so we already talked about the costs, user experience, also volatility and criminal use, which are definitely arguments that you brought up against a Bitcoin in this sense. And I think one other important discussion, and probably, I guess, we could fill hours to discuss that, is really about, let's say, the benefit or the utility of Bitcoin, right? Because if I remember your article, also the papers you wrote on the paper in particular with Ulrich Binzahl on the topic, where you basically argue that Bitcoin has really no social benefit, is not used for productive activities, so basically does not contribute to the production potential, economically speaking, and does also not provide any, you know, yields like, you know, interest rates, government bonds, or even rent income, you know, if you rent an apartment. But on the contrary, that resources are channeled more into unproductive activities and redistribution. Maybe you can quickly elaborate on that aspect. Jürgen, we did, I think, a whole podcast episode on that, but maybe to, you know, to bring this up to the listeners' attention, what you meant by that aspect.
Okay. Yeah. So that is then, and I turn the sequence, what you just said, around. So that focuses on the change narrative of the Bitcoin community, focusing on the asset quality of Bitcoin. So it has become an asset in the perception of the community that attracts inflows. So there we distinguish between two kind of assessments. One is a financial asset. A financial asset normally comes with certain traits, and you listed them, like if I buy a bond, it generates interest rates. If I buy a share, I get a dividend. If I buy real estate, an apartment or a house, I can collect rent. So there's a cash flow generated by the financial asset. Bitcoin doesn't generate any of this. So, and that's why we also said, if you apply the standard methods of calculating a fair value, in this respect, it would be zero for Bitcoin, because it doesn't generate that cash flow. But then again, there are other assets in markets that are traded that attract money inflows, which also don't generate necessarily the calculable yields or cash flows that I just mentioned. So like raw
gold,
materials,
right?
We can discuss gold separately, maybe copper and the like. So, but they are used for industrial production, and so on and so on and so on. So there's a demand for the usage in the real economy. That defines their price. And then in that context, there's an add-on, and there are sometimes exaggerations. Markets foresee a particular increase or shortage on the demand side or on the supply side. And therefore, the actual market price can be higher or lower than what the effective usage in the industrial production would justify. So, and apply this to Bitcoin, then you will see that the use case and the trades of a traditional financial asset are lacking. And yeah, that's in a nutshell why I think that there's no use.
And how would this compare to gold? Because you mentioned this is kind of a special case, right? Because it also doesn't provide a return, so discounted cash flow would also be kind of zero, right? How does this compare from your perspective?
Okay, gold is really a special thing. The establishment of gold as an asset that is with high demand goes back to about 6,000 years. So back then, there was no financial market with the questions that you asked me and that we just discussed. So it took thousands of years, millennia of years, to have it established before these trades came into play. And therefore, the comparison is a bit problematic. So nowadays, it needs different things to be established. Then it's a physical good, which you cannot copy or imitate. You remember the alchemists who tried to create gold artificially. It didn't work. Now, Bitcoin is basically a software, an algorithm. Correct me if I use now wrong technical terms. But it is not excluded that someone comes up with a technology or a concept that is by nature similar, but much better. So the functionality or the promise of Bitcoin could be replaced easily. And the dominance and the belief globally cannot be compared to that of gold with a tradition of more than 6,000 years. Bitcoin is there for about 16 years. So like many other technologies, if you focus on the technology aspect, I think 90 to 99% of all technologies will be replaced by better technologies in the first 10 years. But gold has also many, many, many use cases in effective production. So not talking about the jewelry tradition that it represents status, that it will not degenerate over time, that it has been used for, that it has been used as currencies in the past, and people will remember that. So it's enshrined in the societal memories of many societies. It's effectively used in electronics, in medicine, biotech, aerospace, optics industry, chemical industry, you name it. The pieces of gold that are used there are normally very small, but it's globally used. And there, the things apply that I mentioned in the context of other raw materials. So there's an effective usage in industrial production. And then, of course, based on the other aspects that we discussed and the long tradition as an asset, they add a prime. And maybe the price is too high, yes, but it's an exaggeration. But there's a reference with a value bigger than zero.
Basically, because of this, so two aspects, what I get from your response. One is really that the alternative use and also physical use, like in the industry, in medicine, you know, as jewelry, so which kind of, you know, has utility and justifies, let's say, a price larger than zero, if you will. And secondly, also like, you know, that it cannot be copied. So if you refer to the alchemist, I mean, there are a lot of books and a lot of stories about that. I mean, it was obviously a little bit before my time, but at least what you read here.
Even before my time.
I can imagine that. Yes, indeed. What I think where a Bitcoiner would maybe disagree is on this topic of copying. I mean, you can technically copy Bitcoin, right? The code is open. The code is open source. This is also why we probably have, I don't know, 30,000-40,000 of crypto assets today out there, because we could even, you know, copy it now and we have our own coin in 2 minutes, right? That works. So here, it's definitely the case. But it's often also argued in this space that this is like a very strong first user advantage, right? And you also said, very often in the first 10 years, you know, these technologies basically get completely, or maybe lose ground because others just speed up and then they are number one. And interestingly for Bitcoin, it's, you know, it's the case basically that even the market share like grew in the last years, right? And where Bitcoin is, this is like a first mover advantage, which you cannot get away, you know, Even if, you know, other platforms, other blockchains are probably maybe technologically more capable, right? If you can build decentralized applications, right? All of that stuff. So I think, I think this is something where Bitcoin, I would maybe disagree with this comparison, even if I, you know, get the point you were making. Yeah.
Maybe I add something there, which I find quite interesting. So I would say that the majority of established economists would all say that this is a financial bubble or a bubble, speculative bubble. One thing that is unique about this compared to the speculative bubbles that we have seen in the past, so in the last centuries, starting from the tulip mania, and then with other forms of financial bubbles, and they all are unique in a way. What is truly unique here is that there had been a couple of crashes and the mania came back and the market recovered. So this is something I find very interesting and fascinating, which you haven't seen with these other speculative bubbles. Now, I guess the crypto supporters would say, ah, you see,
it's not a bubble.
Yeah. But I think it's just a new unique feature. And 20 years ago, we would have said, we called these things irrational exuberances and irrational bubbles. But in the meantime, we've seen that there can be rational bubbles. So we've seen a sequence of bubbles in the last, 30 years or so. If you see a bubble inflating as an investor, and even if you're realizing that this is a bubble, you're absolutely sure that this is a bubble, you can be seduced to join the train, invest, and bet that you will manage to get out before the bubble bursts. So it can be absolutely rational as investment to go into a bubble. You know that it's a bubble, but you are confident enough to get in and get out in time. And there might be even industries who feed that bubble, who have huge marketing tools, who have huge capacities to influence the demand artificially, effectively in the background to revive such a bubble. In particular, when you have a fixed supply, I avoid the word scarcity. The supply is fixed, and the only variable that counts for the price is demand. So if you manage to have with relatively low free float liquidity, you can have an impact by buying in effective times, and you can try to steer and deflate demand. And this apparently has worked despite two or three crashes.
And I mean, the interesting thing always around, you know, this bubbles, and I remember when I was taking a course around bubbles at university, that of course you always just know afterwards that it was a bubble, right? So probably we should also meet again in 30, 40 years, I don't know, because this is the, you know, to see if this indeed was a bubble, right? Because of course you know, currently you cannot, you don't know, you don't see it.
Yeah. So you're right. The ultimate verdict is there only after the bubble has burst. Having said that, there's a saying that if it walks like a duck, if it sounds like a duck, it's probably a duck. So, and I made the reference to the overwhelming majority of serious economists that they say this is a bubble. Having said that, maybe we bring that in as an example. You will probably remember the dot-com bubble. And there were early warnings from serious economists in the late mid-90s to the late 1990s, warning of that speculative bubble, also based on the valuation of the stock market then. The bubble burst, we all know that. But a couple of years later, when you see then how the various enterprises were developing, a couple of them at least, you think, wow, the valuation back then was not so high compared to how certain internet companies develop, that the warning would have been so justified as it seemed at the moment of the bubble burst. So I fully agree with you. In analyzing what is a financial bubble or not, we have to be very, very careful.
Yeah. And maybe going into one last question around this, you know, bubble utility discussions before we continue to a few other points of critiques you make is you're basically saying, you know, that Bitcoin does not have any utility that like a rational person would use. What would you, for example, say? Because you often hear from the Bitcoin space, like, this is the solution to a lot of social problems. One, for example, around financial inclusion, right? Because this is actually what I remember when I was somewhere in Washington and showed people the Litecoin network, right? It was so easy to download a wallet to send funds, and it wasn't complicated. Euro, dollar, British pound was super complex and you know, had a lot of fees via PayPal, etc. What would you say around this argument, you know, about, let's say, a social contribution of Bitcoin around financial inclusion in particular?
I understand the argument. Having said that, financial inclusion has a couple of layers or levels. The current financial system as it is, or the payment system, is not perfect. Cross-border payments are too expensive, too slow. So there's an issue. But instead of replacing this system with all its advantages, including the provision of credit and loan and the like, the ability to counter economic crashes and the like. So if there's a weakness in the system, you don't replace the entire system to fix a problem that is, compared to the overall system, relatively small. I don't want to belittle the issue of financial exclusion, don't get me wrong, but you have to put this in perspective. And sometimes the reaction is motivated from an emotional perspective, which blurs a bit the analysis. For example, there are debates about if we are going completely electronic with our payments and cash would disappear, or people use less and less cash, what are we doing with the beggars in the street? You cannot give them any coins and cash anymore, and they might not have the devices for this. So this is the wrong perspective. You should target the income situation of these people and not try to preserve their status as beggars. Sometimes the discussion is a bit replaced. So my plea would be to work hard on the shortcomings of the current payment systems, like the cost and the speed of foreign exchange transactions, cross-border transactions, rather than challenging the entire system based on that shortcoming. And there is work already ongoing by the G20. This will probably take a bit of time, but there's the awareness. And there are also other things that we also need to take into account. So when you have cross-border transactions, there are a lot of regulatory requirements, like AML checks, like the conversion into other currencies. And you have those who run those transactions need to have some buffers for risks, the costs for regulatory compliance and the like. Now, the Bitcoin transactions or other transactions that are not part of this regulatory environment, they don't have that burden. What is the consequence from that? If we think these regulations don't make sense, we don't need them, then we could get rid of them. Or we think they make sense. At one point, we need to find a way to have that also on those innovative means of payment that are unregulated. It's a bit like if you compare the traditional conventional taxi driver or the taxi business with Uber. The taxi business is much more regulated than the Uber business, which makes the taxi business more expensive. So this would be a good occasion to think, do we really need all those regulations that taxi drivers need to comply with? So for example, I don't know if this has changed. I remember the taxi drivers had to know all the streets in the city on a map, or even without a map, that they had to memorize this, which is not necessary anymore because everybody uses Google Maps or so. So there are things that have changed, and then regulation needs to be adjusted. But the shortcomings and weaknesses which are there in the traditional financial and payment systems need to be addressed and solved. But I don't think it's a justification for an entire replacement.
Okay, so basically saying that this focus is also not the right one, let's say, you know, the example you did with the beggar in disregard, and also this, let's say, kind of unfair advantage, if you will, for example, that, you know, for example, self-hosted wallets with Bitcoin are currently not regulated, so you have, you know, in this, if you stay in the crypto ecosystem, you don't have a lot of the compliance requirements. I mean, you do if you go to fiat world, right? But you don't when you stay there. Yeah, that this is also, of course, you know, something to consider.
Yeah, we are talking about two different things. The beggar example was about financial inclusion. The other thing was about cross-border transactions. So, for example, remittances. So clearly, there's a need to make remittances cheaper and faster. But when you use those unregulated and unmonitored channels, this also allows it for terrorist finance to use it. So this unregulated transaction channels have two sides, and the best option to choose would be to repair the shortcomings of the existing regulated financial and transaction world.
Understood. So what we basically did now is we talked kind of all the time until this point about Bitcoin itself, and actually not so much of the topic of the reserve. I mean, that's very important to understand, because I mean, I guess this is also the direction where we might go if, you know, there is a lot of skeptics for some reasons for Bitcoin. Probably the Bitcoin reserve might also not be the best idea, but let's see this in the next few minutes. So maybe particular going to the discussion of a Bitcoin reserve now. You mentioned like two arguments, or at least the ones I identified in your article. One is basically about liquidity, so that, you know, the liquidity for the Bitcoin market could be an issue to really get all these Bitcoins that somebody wants to acquire, be it a state, a central bank, sovereign fund. We will disentangle that in a second. And the second argument, and that's maybe something to elaborate on this, Jürgen, that you also say, I mean, just the financial situation wouldn't allow that, right? Or, you know, maybe you can elaborate on that aspect.
Okay. So the liquidity. The liquidity issue, I had in mind the... I don't know if it was in the article, it was about the seizing in a German state, and then they sold it, or they intended to sell it, whereas the new administration, yes, intends to hold it and maybe transfer it to a whatever reserve. Now, the liquidity issue is the following. The market size itself of Bitcoin indicates that there's a lot of liquidity. But for the price finding, what matters is the liquidity of the free float, the size of the free float. But amid the situation in the Bitcoin markets, the holdings of the Bitcoins are quite concentrated. You have the whales, you have the exchanges. So the distribution and the concentration of holdings is quite concentrated. And then, of course, you have the hodlers who don't want to sell anyway. The free float of Bitcoin traded is very small. That means, despite the overall market size, the liquidity is so small that you throw things into the market, it will have a price impact. And that was, in the crypto community, there were warnings that these seized Bitcoins by the state of Saxony, I think it was, would disturb the market and the price. So that was that. Second, in that context, I think there's a regulation or law, government agencies who seize assets from illicit or criminal activities are not allowed to hold them, but get rid of them as soon as possible.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
The underlying logic is that, and I think that's a good and justified one, that the state is not necessarily the best investor. We should not leave it to civil servants or bureaucrats to invest and bet with the money that is ultimately going back to the taxpayer and citizens. And so, as a rule, if it's Bitcoin or anything else, if you seize funds from illicit criminal activities, you have to sell them. So that's the underlying logic. Now, coming back to the reserves, maybe here, Jonas, I can distinguish between the three types. When the proposals came up in the United States, in Europe, from the European Parliament, and in Germany from the Liberal Party, it was not really clear what they were talking about. And to me, what they actually have in mind is still not very clear. So Bitcoin reserve, it can be a couple of things. We distinguished three possible options, starting with the strategic reserves, which we know from oil, gas, and raw materials that are relatively scarce. So a country can say, we want to increase our autonomy and do not want to be dependent on external providers, in particular when there's a shortage in supply. So a strategic oil reserve is a classical example. You hold oil, you don't use it, and in case there's a shortage of oil supply, you can use that to counter the rise in the price. Oil price goes up because Saudi Arabia said we close the taps, and then you have your reserve to counter that development. Now, Bitcoin, in the community of those who support the idea, the expectation is that the price of Bitcoin goes up. So what would you do in the context and definition of a strategic reserve with your Bitcoins when the price goes up? Would you buy now Bitcoins to throw them on the market to reduce the price? It's probably not the idea. And then, like other uses, and that's not, for that we are now prepared, a shortage of Bitcoin for any proper use is not there. So there's no rationale for a strategic reserve in the conventional sense. The second idea that comes to mind is the foreign exchange reserve of central banks. Central banks hold currencies or government bonds from huge currency areas, US dollar, yen, pound, then special drawing rights and artificial currency by the IMF, and gold. So they hold this in order to make their balance sheet more stable, to give a stable foundation to their balance sheet on the asset side, and to have funds or the currency to interfere in foreign exchange market if there are turmoils and you have a sharp appreciation or depreciation of your currency. So that's the purpose of that. So the central bank isn't using its assets to generate a profit. Central bank is not a profit-seeking institution. The big central banks want to defend price stability within their mandate. So we have the 2% doctrine prevailing in the Western world. And they need to have a certain insurance that foreign exchange markets are not getting too volatile. So, and there, the Bitcoin reserve, with its high volatility, could not add additional stability, to the contrary.
But I guess the ministers of finance, they would also, you know, they wouldn't say no to a scenario where there is, you know, a payout, let's say, profits coming from, you know, central banks, from the ECB or Bundesbank, from whatever sources, right? Because that's available for political budget, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why, and I remember the discussion you had with Frank Schaeffler from the Liberal Party. And that's why central banks are independent. That's exactly why central banks are independent, to protect them from the dreams and wishes of finance ministers.
And this independence is, of course, and I mean, also going back to the study program, you know, which is something that is, I guess, also, you know, an advantage when it comes from Europe to the US, and which, you know, we should really observe with caution, like how this develops, because I personally also think there is a really good reason to have this independence. But coming back maybe, Jürgen, to this comparison, maybe of gold, because I understand.
We forgot to discuss the third option.
Sorry, yes.
Sovereign wealth funds. So the government buys Bitcoin to invest in it, to generate money. So sovereign wealth funds are generally observed in countries with very high current account surpluses, most of which are generated by huge raw materials that they have and that they can export, like Norway, or smaller countries with huge and highly liquid and profitable financial centers like Singapore or Saudi Arabia. Now, these countries are characterized by the fact that they generate so much money with those raw materials, or in the case of Singapore, with their financial business, that it's so much that they cannot, it exceeds the budget needs. Even if they're very generous, it exceeds their budget needs. So you have to do something with that. You put the money, therefore, in a sovereign wealth fund. Now, the situation in most of the Western countries, in particular those who are getting demographically older, is that those governments are having too high debt levels. They use a huge fraction of your yearly annual budget to pay for their debts. So the governments don't really have too much money to spend. It's not that they have so much funds and they don't know what to do with it. Now, the idea to have government taxpayer money to invest in a sovereign wealth fund based on Bitcoin is difficult. Let's compare it to someone. You have someone who has a person who has difficulties with his finances and has higher spendings than income and is already indebted rather high. Now this person has the idea to go to the casino and gamble there to solve his or her problems for good. So I know the comparison is maybe not ideal, but most of the Western economies and governments are not in the position to have excessive funds and they don't know what to do with it. So, and that's the third example of what we basically categorized. But what can well be is that the effective idea that we will then see in the coming days or weeks that's going to be proposed wherever is a new model.
So it was basically, to recap that, because I think that was super important, it was basically a strategic reserve in a sense of, as you know, this was coming from as countries had with oil, right? So basically to interact with the market if, you know, the supply and demand is somehow mismatching, so then you can basically provide a little bit more demand to the market, but which is not about speculating or anything. And the second one was basically about foreign exchange, reserve build up, also to be able to be active in this. In this market, if needed, also of course coming back, from things like Bretton Woods, etc. But this is also the gold case, I guess. And the third one is really the sovereign wealth funds, and it's actually also what we've seen, for example, with Abu Dhabi, right, where they might be one of the countries where you said, the debt is not as important as spending the money somewhere, which also recently went into Bitcoin ETFs with a few, I think, 3-digit millions. So that's like that's then kind of the options. What I would like to understand, Jürgen, I think you discussed this also in the article, is the comparison a little bit, compared to gold, because we discussed this previously that of course you don't see Bitcoin being a digital, one-to-one form of gold. We discussed that, right? But generally, this gold, there is a lot of gold in central bank balance sheets, right? So there is. One can understand why this claim comes up if people perceive this as somehow a form of digital gold, right? Would you do see a specific, arguments for that? Or would you say this is just because this grew kind of over time, be based on Bretton Woods, all of this, so it's a different game? Or how would you see this gold reserve comparison, maybe?
Mm-hmm. So you have a long tradition in gold holdings with central banks, and they all stem from the time of the gold standards, later Bretton Woods. It's coming from there. And after the, let's say, effective end of the gold standard, with the dollar being the leading currency being based on gold in 1971, so after Bretton Woods was effectively abandoned, central banks started to sell gold. So with the end with the effective end of the gold standard or indirect gold standard via Bretton Woods, central banks tended to decrease their holdings. With the exception of some, like the, I think the Bundesbank has never sold gold. I hope I say nothing wrong. But most of the central banks reduced their gold holdings. Even the IMF had sold gold. Some governments have sold gold. They believed that it's not needed. And they also thought for the central banks on the asset side, there are other assets which have a potential use, like interference in FX markets when there's a need. And these very secure assets like government bonds denominated in foreign exchange generate effectively a yield. But during the 2000s, they came to an agreement and reduced their gold sellings because they didn't want to have a too strong impact on the market.
And this holds particular for Western economies, I guess, right? Because China, I think, is currently building up, for example, the reserves in India, aren't they?
So this agreement not to sell so much, but have an agreement to coordinate it a bit, not to disturb the market too much, that was between 2000 and the financial crisis. So not talking about today. The 1970s to 80s was the declining importance of gold for central banks. Now, after the financial crisis, things changed. So there were a couple of central banks who went to gold again to increase their stability. There was some mistrust in the established fiat financial system. And then, and that's the point you are raising, a couple of bigger emerging markets economies went back into gold to reduce their dependence on the US dollar. So China, Russia, India, and the like, they diversified away from the US dollar. But obviously, this was not only driven by the attraction of gold, but also by political reasons, to have a higher independence from the United States and its currency.
And yeah, I mean, that's, I think, will be very interesting to see how this political pressure or how political situation evolves, right? Because currently we do see, of course, I think personally, a lot of concerning developments in the US, right? And where, you know, maybe that's a political priority for the next few years. I'm not saying political for the central bank, right? But generally for politics to become independent, because then, of course, this aspects that we currently see in some of these emerging market economies might become more relevant when it is about becoming independent of the US, of the US dollar. It's not about, you know, what you alluded to before, strategic reserve in this sense, as we have with oil or foreign exchange, but about independence. And that could have, or I would say this could, of course, change some things, some thinkings around this.
And we have seen different developments, and the rally of gold in the last years is definitely an exciting phenomenon, I'm sure.
Yeah, then Jürgen, we already speak for 70 minutes now. Time really flies.
Jesus.
So I think we really need to come to an end pretty quickly. I really appreciate you being part of this discussion, also over the years that we have always been, you know, in very constructive exchange around various topics, be it CBDC, be it Bitcoins, being others. So really appreciate it that you took the time to be a part of this this podcast here. And maybe just one last question to you. You know, if people, of course, we link the article from the FAZ, we link the paper you wrote together with Ulrich Binzeil. We also link the episode where we discussed this paper and also got feedback from you on that. But besides that, where can people, you know, follow you if they would like to see more, you know, of your work, what you're doing?
So, in general, what I like to do is when I have thought things through, I like to write them down. So my preferred channel of communication is publication. So if time allows, then a longer article deep dive into a matter is my preferred channel of communication. I know people don't have the time to read all that. Then I sometimes prefer to have it shorter in a piece published in a newspaper or so. And I know there are even more and more people who don't have the time to read those articles, and therefore I I have a, I most of the times I've published in, on Bitcoin with Ulrich Binzai, and we share the workload that I, poor me, go to X or Twitter, and he has a shorter message and summary of the publications than on LinkedIn. So, but for those who don't have the time, I really suggest at least read one of the shorter texts. So I know I'm confronted all the time with a couple of comments on X, and I would say 90% of the comments and those who comment have never read a single word of what I've written. And the advantage is you can bring your thoughts in a sequence, in an order, and you can share with others what you have read, what you have reflected upon, and to share your knowledge with others, and then you can debate. But it's important to have it read.
Absolutely. And I can really encourage everybody to really do this exercise and at least read one, because I really agree. And I think we discussed this also in another episode with Michael, our co-host, where we often tend to think, you know, it's the discussions is always just based on one or two sentences, right? And then people say, ah, oh, you know, he cannot be serious. He doesn't know things. I mean, going into our direction. But where it's getting fun is really if you digest things, right? If you write them down, you structuring, you debate around all of that. And that's exactly also why, for the listeners, I guess, also for these kind of series on the Bitcoin reserve, we had first an episode with Frank Scheffler, who was very positive. Then we had this episode today, which was rather on the negative side, let's say. And you also have obviously seen me in a different role, because I try to be the kind of neutral moderator. I hoped it worked out. Jürgen, you tell me.
Yeah, I think that's independent of the Bitcoin topic. That's a development where I'm not happy with, that in podcasts, influencer things, talk shows and the like, the moderator has a particular role, a stance, and acts sometimes like an activist that wants to corner the other side, which is not the case with you. Therefore, it was my utmost pleasure to take your invitation. And that's the way it should be.
Definitely. And I really appreciate that, and also for the community. So that was the purpose. So, you know, please also not send now 1,000 comments on why did you not go into this topic here and that topic there. This was on purpose. We had an episode which was pro. We had one which is now con. And, you know, maybe we take some time to bring all of this discussion together and put also our opinion around that, if we think this is appropriate in the next weeks, maybe. And Jürgen, maybe we also find, another format, in a few months or so, we can have you also as part of this podcast in a debate where we then have a neutral moderator, pro, con person, and then figure something out. So this invite is, just stated, let's say, and we can see if we figure out a setup. It was, as I said, a real pleasure. Thanks for sharing your insight. And it's also for me always nice to get out of the bubble and to talk about people that are also very deep into these topics. And again, thanks for being here, and to the audience, thanks for listening, for staying in the whole now 75 minutes. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to your YouTube channel for the audio, also on the podcast player, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wheresoever. Share it with your family, friends, who you think should learn about digital assets, Bitcoin and co. So again, thanks for tuning in. See you for next episode, and thanks for listening, and thanks for being with us, Jürgen.
Thank you for having me.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.